All right, if you will, take your Bibles and look with me in Isaiah chapter 17 on this subject of a famine in the land, a famine in the land. I'm not talking just about whenever we hear periods of dry spells in the weather and suddenly there's a famine. Certainly that continues to be a problem in various places of the world, even sometimes affecting certain areas here in the United States. But I'm speaking primarily of a spiritual famine, where when the Lord will give a nation over to its idolatrous ways, how difficult it is to find a place where sinners can come and rejoice together and hear the gospel. I'm confident that even as prosperous as the United States is in hard times, there are many of the Lord's people in different places, not only here but throughout the world, that can say, we're in a desert place. There are a lot of the Lord's sheep that are scattered that don't have the privilege that we do of meeting week in and week out. I don't know how you count this of being able to come aside a few times a week, even to worship together in fellowship with the Lord's people, but I can tell you some people I'm in contact with would love it because they don't have it. And they'll write me, they'll email, they'll say, we can sit and watch DVDs or listen to your messages, but it's just not the same as being able to meet week in and week out with the Lord's people. And you know what I'm talking about. We all get busy, our work schedules, and you know, when you miss being with the Lord's people and hearing the gospel, it creates a hunger and a thirst within you. It causes you to yearn for a time that you can be again with his people. And I think that's a good thing. I would worry more if it wasn't that way. But let's not take for granted what the Lord has given us. I'm thinking, I told you to stay in Isaiah 17, stay there, but Amos 8 and verses 11 and 12, where the Lord said, the days will come, and he uses behold. So whenever you see that in scripture, it's a way to catch attention. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will send a famine in the land. We talked about that in our Bible class in 2 Corinthians 4, where it speaks of the God of this world having blinded men, and how the translators put in there a small g, and in reality giving that blame to Satan is the way it's interpreted. But who is the God of this world? It ought to be capital G. It is God's prerogative to save or destroy. It is God's prerogative to reveal Christ or pass by. And here it's very clear. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will send a famine in the land. Not a famine of bread. Even in the worst of situations, natural men can always find bread somewhere. Nor a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Lord. And I ask you, what would you prefer to do without? Hearing the words of the Lord or doing without bread and water for a while? I'll tell you, when you look at the long-term effects, I prefer that the Lord continue to teach me his word. Put me somewhere where I can hear it, even if I don't have the best job in the world, even if I have to pass up that promotion, whatever, you know, to be able to be where that gospel is preached. Because you see the end, they shall wander from sea to sea, and from north even to the east, they shall run to and fro to seek the word of the Lord and shall not find it. Now, who seeks? Well, it's those the Lord has taught. I think sometimes we think that we're going to be preserved from having to find a place where we can hear the gospel because we're the Lord's. The Lord, and we're going to see that in Isaiah 17, in all of his judgments that he brings, his elect are affected. You know, Elijah that prayed that it not rain for 3.5 years, he was affected. He said, what was that brought about? Famine in the land. It was a visual demonstration of a true famine that men ignored, and that was a spiritual famine. And yet he had to go through it. Jeremiah, David, all of these suffered. There's a remnant according to grace, but it may be, I don't know, it may be that the Lord bring us to where we'll seek the word of the Lord and not find a place where it's faithfully preached. Let's don't take for granted what we have right here, right now. So come back to Isaiah chapter 17. Here, the burden of Damascus. If you look on a map, that's up in Syria. It's the northeast, borders Israel, the northeastern part. One of these nations. We've looked at Moab. These are all surrounding nations of Israel. But behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. That may not mean much to you, but that would be like saying New York City is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. The cities of Aor are forsaken. They shall be for flocks which lie down, and none shall make them afraid. In other words, there's no population left, just animals running wild in the streets. Real picture of desolation. But now here is an interesting connection in verse 3, because it says, the fortress also shall cease from Ephraim. What was Ephraim? Ephraim, if you look where the land was given to Ephraim, one of the tribes of Israel, that's what was known, would be known as Samaria, where they, the servant of Solomon, went and divided the 10 tribes, took them away, and began to worship the golden calf again after Solomon's death, divided the kingdom. Two remain in the south, Judah, Benjamin, all the rest, the 10 tribes. And the Lord allowed that sort of false worship go on for centuries. There were periods of time where he would intervene and bring warnings. But here, he's speaking now of a finality that he would not allow that continue on. Ephraim being just like Damascus, you think Damascus of the Syrians, being mentioned the same breath as Ephraim, which was the seat of this false worship in the northern part of Israel. What had happened? There was an alliance where, for reasons of prosperity or whatever, Ephraim had allied themselves with Damascus, the enemy, to even go against Judah, where Hezekiah was. I'm just giving you a little bit of history here, trying to do it as simply as possible. But the Lord is about to break that alliance. If you remember back, actually a few chapters back in Isaiah chapter 7, remember we saw this. In the days of Ahaz, that's when this took place. The son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it. So they're trying to bring Jerusalem down, but could not prevail against it. Why was the Lord preserving Jerusalem? Was it because they were any better? No, that had to be preserved. That was Judah. That was the line from which Christ should come. And so they could not prevail against it. But look here in verse 2, it was told the house of David or of Judah. See, I'm the northern tribes and the southern, Judah being the house of David, saying Syria is confederate with Ephraim. You would think that Ephraim, being one of the 10 tribes, would have had an interest in preserving Judah, but now they were confederate with the enemies to come against Jerusalem. And so the Lord ordained that it go on for a while. But here we're reading now in chapter 17 where the Lord is prophesying that end. That end. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria. They shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts. And in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin. What was the glory of Jacob but that promise that God gave, that they would be as the sands of the sea and the stars of the heaven? But now he says they'll be made thin. He's going to thin it out. He's going to separate the true from the false. And the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. And it shall be as when the harvest man gathereth the corn and reapeth the ears with his arm. And it shall be as he that gathereth ears in the valley of Rephaim. You say, well, what is that about? Think of a cornfield. When those stalks are first growing, everything's green. I like to drive down a road, country road, and look at the green corn and then see the corn actually come out on it. Everything looks, it's picture perfect. But what does it look like after they've gone through and cut it all down? Just, it's hard to believe that that's the same field. And that's what the Lord is saying. It shall be as when the harvestman gathereth the corn and reapeth the ears with his arm. It's going to be desolate. Be desolate. Verses 6 through 8. In all of the talk of destruction here, just like we've seen the pattern in other portions of Scripture, there's hope. There's mercy to be had for the Lord's people. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it. I like that. A remnant. As the shaking of an olive tree. It's talking about when they, I don't know how you harvest an olive tree, but back in this day, there was I've seen some documentaries, these machines they have now, where they literally go and shake the whole tree. And the thing falls into this bin. And they just keep moving down these groves. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, and the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, saith the Lord God of Israel. In other words, in all this shaking down, the Lord would preserve himself a remnant. At that day shall a man look to his maker. Well, this remnant. And his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. Who's that? Isn't that Christ, the Holy One of Israel, the one who came to work out righteousness on behalf of his people? And he shall not look to the altars, the work of his hands, neither shall respect that which his fingers have made, either the groves or the images. In other words, the Lord is going to turn him from that false hope in which he had been to that point. But then it gets back again, in verses 9 and following here, to actually the overthrow. See, first he talks about, it speaks here of the destruction of Syria and the 10 tribes of the north. That's who's represented by Ephraim. And how did that happen in history except for Assyria came down and took them all away? Do you realize those 10 tribes no longer exist today? They haven't since. No one can find any trace. You can try to trace your genealogy back. None can trace it. It was so thoroughly destroyed by the Assyrian army. God did away with it. But then what we're reading here in verses 9 to the end of the chapter, how God then sovereignly turns his destruction upon the very nation that he brought to destroy the 10 tribes of the north and Syria. That's what this is, the overthrow of the Assyrian army. Because when they came down and took away the 10 tribes, in their mind, they thought, we can keep going and destroy Jerusalem as well. And God stopped it. And why? Well, Judah. No way that Jerusalem could have been destroyed before Christ came. Now, it happened in 70 AD. God brought his son. And you get in the New Testament, read how he ordained that those Roman armies would surround Jerusalem and completely ravage it and destroy it. I believe, as Brother David was reading there in Revelation 11, that's what was being described there. The two witnesses that were there were, that's the church. But they lived through the days of the destruction, what is spiritually called Sodom in Egypt. That was Jerusalem. It was being foretold, even there in Revelation. What would happen? God would destroy it. His witnesses would be safe. They would lie dead for a while, and the nations would rejoice and mock. There was persecution that went on in that first century, but then we see them ascended up into heaven in the glory. Where are they? They're seated with Christ. Man can kill the body, but not the soul. And the witnesses were raised up again from the street. That didn't kill the witness of the gospel. It continues today. But Jerusalem's destroyed. Blindness has been brought upon them after Christ came. But here, they had to be preserved. So that's what we read, how God would destroy them. In that day, verse 9, shall his strong cities be as a forsaken bough and an uppermost branch which they left because of the children of Israel, and there shall be desolation. Because thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation, and hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength. Therefore shalt thou plant pleasant plants, and shalt set it with strange slips. In the day shalt thou make thy plant to grow, and in the morning shalt thou make thy seed to flourish, but the harvest shall be a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. Woe to the multitude of many people. Here's where the Assyrian nation now is being addressed. Which make a noise like the noise of the seas unto the rushing of nations, that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nations shall rush like the rushing of mighty waters, but God shall rebuke them. And they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. And behold, at evening tide, trouble, and before the morning, he is not. is speaking of Assyria. You know, for a while, God raised that nation up, gave them power. But once God's purpose with that nation was done, they became nothing. Who thinks of Assyria today? You can go back and read in history, Assyria, there's a lot of history. Persia, Assyria. But today, who fears them? It says, at evening tide, trouble, and before the morning is not. This is the portion of them that spoil us, and the lot of them that rob us. So let me just give you a few thoughts to hang some of this on. Let's look first of all at the nature of the famine. As I talked about a famine, this is not something that happened overnight. We saw back already where there had been this alliance between Ephraim and Syria. And for a while it prospered. The northern tribes of Israel seemingly, economically, politically, all seemed to be at peace and rest. But then in the Lord's time, when he purposed to, and they gave glory to that alliance. They really believed that because they had aligned themselves with Syria, that they were better off. It's like people today that feel like if they're aligned with an organization where the gospel's not preached, they're better off. They think there's more people, there's more fellowship, there's more money to go around. They boast in their mission programs and things that they can do, so-called mission programs. But what kind of alliance is it? If it's not built on the truth, it's a false alliance. And God will destroy it. We just don't know when. All right? So that's the nature of the famine here. Damascus itself becoming, as it says there, a ruinous heap in verse 1. A ruinous heap. That happened historically. Now it's been rebuilt since. And, it continues in blindness today. I don't have any interest to go there. But it's the seed of another type of religion today that stands opposed to the gospel. So nothing has changed, even though the city's been rebuilt. But here the lesson is given that whatever appears to be prosperous for a time in men's eyes is only that, just an appearance. And God will destroy it. God will bring that famine. Even to the country towns, when it says there the cities of Aroer are forsaken. If you look on the map, these were towns surrounding Damascus, some of the villages in the countryside. And the whole thing here is to show that none were spared. None were spared. There's no place to hide. False religion, for a while, appears to be safe. I see some of it on TV. I haven't attended any kind of service in any of these congregations in a long, long, long time. If I do, sometimes it's because it's a funeral or you have to sit through it. But even there, I try not to be there, participate. I'd rather just go visitation and then pay my respects and go home, you know, not be involved with the actual, however they do their worship. But people feel safe, even in the face of death, even in the face of calamity. Where do they run? They run to these houses of worship. They feel like there's an answer there somehow. They run to these altars that men have built. And yet what the Lord is showing here is the day's coming when even those places will be forsaken. They will not help a person in a day of trouble. And that word forsaken is a strong word. They're forsaken. They're not only forsaken of men, but they're forsaken of God. And when God rips off the mask of man's religion, there's nothing there. You find out that that's all there is. It's just it's an empty sepulcher. But all these stately houses that once were now converted into sheep, wandering sheep. That's what the picture is there in verse 2, where flocks go and lie down. Just think of an old ghost town. That's what's being depicted here. And then, not just that, but as we saw in verse 3, the strongholds of Israel. In other words, the 10 tribes of the north. That again, their history, you can go back and read it in the book of the Kings, where they followed after the servant of Solomon and went and established in Samaria a new center of worship of the golden calf. Actually, they went further. They created two calves. One golden calf wasn't enough. We're gonna have one for the north, one for the south. Protect us on both ends. That was their thinking. But what they had done had been joined with Syria in invading Judah. And you know what? You participate in the plot, you participate in the ruin. That's basically what the Lord is saying here. I wouldn't want to be identified with works religion. Not from what I read in these scriptures. It's a condemned house. If you see these houses, drive down, you see big old red X, condemned. It's just been being waiting. You know, they're just waiting to tear it down. What kind of people do you find in there? Sometimes drug addicts, prostitutes, people just run in there and think, well, the house is still there. We can, but it's condemned. What hope is there? What life is there, really, in that? Nothing. I think about that. You know, people still investing millions and millions of dollars into putting up these houses of worship and boasting in it. But it's a condemned house. It's a condemned house. I wouldn't contribute a dime to it. It's condemned. I'm not going to align myself with, you know, with a message that promotes works and makes men believe that based on their profession or something they do, that they can somehow work their way to heaven. It's a condemned house. A day's coming when any identified with it will be stripped of any glory that they thought they had. You know, as the Lord has taught me, there's nothing more precious. I don't care what the house looks like. You know, we can have a comfortable place to meet. That's not what's important. What's important is the Christ who's worshiped. You can have the best looking house in the world, but it's nothing but a painted sepulcher. Unless Christ is preached, unless God is worshiped there in truth. And you can see then how the Lord determined to waste it. What it does, it gives you and me a picture of exactly what God thinks of men's works and the works of men's hands, even what they consider the best. It's nothing but filthy rags, nothing but dung. What do you do with dung but just spread it? That's exactly what we see here, where it says there in verse 4, and in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin. In other words, cut off. But still there's hope even in that, isn't there? Not destroyed. Made thin. Thin it out. Thin it out. But there's still there, even in that, few left. A few left. But as far as the whole, nothing but skin and bones. God was destroying them slowly but surely, as a moth might eat away at a fabric. If you look in Hosea chapter 5 and verse 12, I know I'm having you turn to some passages here that you may not be used to finding. But just keep going to the right. You'll find it just before Amos. Hosea chapter 5. Hosea prophesied during this time as well concerning Ephraim. And again, where you see Ephraim, it's the whole of the 10 tribes. That's all I think you need to know. the whole of these 10 tribes. The center was there in Samaria. Ephraim is oppressed in verse 11 and broken in judgment because he willingly walked after the commandment. After what commandment? The commandment of men. Notice, willingly. You might sit there and say to me, well, you're writing off all of these other organizations. You know, you're making it sound like they're all worthy of condemnation. Well, they are. They willingly worship where they do. If you don't believe it, try to get them to come over and hear the gospel you're preaching. They'd rather die than sit where you're sitting and hear this message that gives Christ all the glory. They willingly contribute. They willingly build. They willingly do what they do after the commandments of men. If they hear something, they'd rather get the pastor's opinion. Let me find out what my pastor would say first, and then I'll see. Well, you can see in verse 12, therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth, and to the house of Judah as rottenness or a worm. In other words, the destruction doesn't always come immediately. How does apostasy show itself? And friends, I mean, right here in this congregation, the same possibility is there. Regardless of how this congregation began, any sort of deviation from the gospel, and we were talking today, back there in the study with the men, I got this little postcard reminding me that it'll be 15 years. Somebody's been tracking this. Every fifth year, 10th year, 15th year, they send these things. They want you to order pins for everybody to wear, that we've been around now for 15 years. That was from the time we actually, you know, organized. But regardless of how it began, unless the Lord keeps us, that erosion may already have begun. As a moth. You know, if you've got the garment hanging in the closet, you don't hear any real noise like a, you know, jackhammer. But you go to pull it out, you hadn't worn it in a while, and you pull it out, and something just falls apart in your hand. What happened? Well, the moths ate it. Or termites, or worms, whatever. It's over time. And that's the nature of that famine. There are a lot of people that are right now in a false faith and a false religion, but it's not apparent to them that there's any destruction going on. Because the building's still there. People still attending. Parking lot's full. They don't have any problem getting another preacher. All of these things that they boast in, and yet the Lord's already given them over to their own reprobate minds. So that's the picture here. But let me just dwell in the remaining time on this second point, the hope. The hope. What is the hope? Is there mercy to be had with the Lord? I'm thankful there is. You're looking at a man who was once of that number. As I look back and see my upbringing, the type of religion that I was in. They called it fundamentalism. People that boasted in believing in the King James Version of the Bible and had rules and regulations to promote what they called righteousness. They had degrees of separation. I remember learning that. You know, there was first, second, and third degree separation. Talk about Pharisees. You know, first degree was if this person was involved in something you felt to be wrong, then you separated from them. That was first degree. Second degree was if one of their friends, maybe they weren't, but one of their friends was involved with something that shouldn't be, then you separated from them because of their friends. And third degree was, again, down the line. However far you needed to go to separate, show yourself pure. That's what you were to do. I grew up with that. Yet here I am today preaching the gospel of Christ. Why? Well, there's mercy with the Lord. That's all I know. You know, I was counted among one of those grapes when the shaking of the tree that didn't get shaken down. One of those olives up there. That was that by mistake? No. Lord purposed it. There's a remnant today according to the election of grace. And I believe that's what's described there in verses 6 through 8. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it. The whole notion there is left on purpose. Not just left because, boy, it was lucky. I was lucky. People say that. No, there's nothing to do with luck. The whole notion of the word is left on purpose. You say, well, how do I know if I'm one of those? Well, look at here. I think it gives us pretty clear evidence in verses 7 and 8. Such a man, not many, you know, there are few that be saved, but such a man will look to his maker. That's the first thing. There's a looking. God gives you eyes to see. How could you see otherwise unless God give you eyes to see? So there's a looking to his maker. I don't believe that's just in the sense of physically, but spiritually. Who has made me anew? Who has given me eyes to see? Spiritual eyes. Well, all the glory goes to God. Goes to God. And so, those that are so taught acknowledge that all things are of him. I haven't got a righteousness, but what it has been made for me. He's my maker. I've not got a peace before a holy God, but what it has been made for me. When Christ died, peace was made. I didn't have anything to do with it. Just like I didn't have a thing to do with my being born, being created. So on my salvation, that peace has been made for me. So I give all the glory to the Maker. And where God is my Maker, he is the one that causes me to see and to give him all the glory. Look at Job chapter 35. And again, this is Elihu speaking, which I believe he was the only one of those friends that the Lord gave any kind of instruction to. He was the only one that was exempt when the Lord told Job to pray for the others and offer sacrifices. I already told you, I tend to believe it could have been none other than Christ himself in a pre-incarnate state. You can't find fault with any of these, but he asked the question, beginning with verse 9, by reason of the multitude of oppressions, they make the oppressed to cry. They cry out by reason of the arm of the mighty. But none saith, where is God my maker who giveth songs in the night? You think about all these others in Syria and the 10 tribes of Israel. When that affliction came, none of them, even with all of that affliction, were brought to repentance. See, when you're left to yourself, you do not turn to God. You do not turn to Christ. You'll turn to every other thing but. That's what it is to be left to yourself. But if you find one in that day that looks to his maker, that's grace. That's grace. But look at here in verse 10, who giveth songs in the night. I don't think that's just talking about the physical night. But I can attest the times when the Lord wakes you up in a time of trouble and gives you songs in the night. But any affliction cause you to look to Christ once again, rest in Him, who teacheth us more than the beasts of the earth and maketh us wiser than the fowls of heaven. How's that? But in the wisdom of Christ. So I believe that's an evidence of being one of the Lord's, given eyes to see our Maker, our Maker. He's the Creator. He's the Sovereign. But secondly, coming back to Isaiah 17, and His eyes shall have respect, reverence, honor to one person, the Holy One of Israel. You remember when Christ went into the synagogue there in Mark, and that man with a demon said, "Thou art the Holy One of Israel, hast thou come to destroy us?" He knew who he was. There was no question. When it says there in Scripture, he died the just for the unjust, he's the Holy One of Israel. The one righteousness which God had purposed and ordained that should come and work it out on behalf of his people. The Holy One of Israel. In other words, when a man is taught by the Spirit of God, that's where he looks for his hope. To Christ alone. Where are you looking? You know, there's nowhere else you would want to look. And so, again, in evidence of being of this remnant of grace, a remnant according to the election of grace, a sanctified remnant, in other words, set apart to Christ, his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. When people come alongside and try to dissuade you and try to tell you, well, there's something more, that's where my eyes are fixed all the more solidly on the Holy One of Israel. I dare not look away. I don't want to look away. Why should I look away? He's the one that's given me eyes to see Him. Christ, our righteousness, you see. And then the third characteristic, and I'll stop with this, is there in verse 8. The respect is toward the Holy One of Israel, Christ. And regardless of whatever idols or respect that I may have had of the works of my own hands, in other words, working out my own righteousness before, I don't go back there. I fled that city. And I continue to flee. I don't look back like Lot's wife. You know, there's no turning back. I run to Christ. It says he shall not look to the altars. You see, in all three instances, it all has to do with a look. At that day shall a man look to his Maker. His eyes shall have respect. In other words, see only the Holy One of Israel, only that righteousness that Christ came and worked out. And upon completion of his death, God declared holy and righteous everyone for whom he died. And verse 8, he shall not look to the altars. And when people hand me a book on a certain Bible topic, I begin to just kind of scan it. First of all, to see if there's anything in it concerning Christ. And then if I see Christ's name, I kind of pause on that page and look and see, well, what are they saying about it? Is this author giving all of the glory to Christ and salvation, or is it a mix? Is there works? Is there leaven in it? Well, if there's leaven in it, I'm not going to look. I don't need to read the book. You know, and people say, well, you kind of got to go around some of that stuff. No. That's the works of men's hands. Those are the altars for which I have no respect. And people get upset. Well, you're not respecting this man. Do you realize how long he's been preaching? Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. My eyes are for Christ only. Not because I had anything to do with it, but because of his grace and mercy, having taught this sinner that apart from him, there is no hope. There is no hope. I'll tell you this, and I'll close with this. Any affliction that the Lord has brought us through, I don't care how deep the trouble, if it's been to strip us of any self-righteousness or self-glory or anything that we thought in any way could recommend us to God and to bring us to be nothing but one of those grapes or one of those little olives that was spared because of Christ. I thank God for every trouble. I thank God for every affliction, every trial, every winding path that has brought me here to be able to stand here today and tell you Christ is all. I pray the Lord would so teach us. All right.